All right, so we're back, and today we're diving deep into Isaiah, but not the whole book. We're looking at chapters 40 through 66, and the big question we're tackling is who actually wrote these chapters?
It's a question that has puzzled scholars for centuries.
Yeah, and for this deep dive, we're turning to a lecture by Robert Van Noy.
Oh, yeah, he's a
He's a biblical scholar, digs into
really gets into the nitty-gritty.
all the arguments and stuff.
Absolutely.
Now, I know what you might be thinking.
With that?
Why should I care
Becca.
about who wrote some ancient text, right?
Yeah, you seem a little.
But trust me on this one, because this goes way beyond just some academic debate.
It really
It
does.
gets to the core of how we understand, prophecy,
Yeah.
comfort, God's power.
Absolutely. And how all of that connects to our lives today. It's not
Exact.
just ancient history.
Right.
It's about our lives, too.
Exactly.
These chapters, they're packed with messages of hope and deliverance, especially when you think about the context of exile.
Yeah.
But that question of authorship, like who actually wrote these words,
Yeah.
throws a wrench in things.
Yeah.
Did Isaiah, who lived way before the Babylonian exile, actually foresee these events
Right.
and write these words? Or did somebody else come along later and kind of, I know,
Put words in his mouth.
yeah, attribute them to him, you know?
So let's get into those doubts
Okay.
about Isaiah. Like, what are the things that make these scholars scratch their heads?
Well, critical scholars bring up a few interesting points.
Okay.
First off, they say that the ideas and concepts in chapters 40 to 66, they don't really match up with the earlier chapters.
Okay.
Like, early Isaiah, he really hammers on judgment on
Right.
Israel's sin. But then later Isaiah,
Yeah.
it's all about comfort and restoration.
So it's like a shift in tone.
It is. It's like you're listening to two different voices, almost, thematically speaking.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay.
And then there's the language, the style.
Okay.
It's like every writer has their own fingerprint,
Right.
their
Yeah.
own way with words.
Like your own voice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the critics, they point out that the vocabulary is different, sentence structures different
No, okay.
between the two sections. And they say, well, that suggests different authors.
Right.
For instance, the word holy, way more common in chapters 40 to 66
Oh, interesting. Okay.
compared to the earlier chapters.
Couldn't a writer's style change over time?
Hello?
I mean, like, couldn't Isaiah's language have maybe become more, I don't know, elaborate
Well,
or just focused on different themes as his ministry went on?
it's possible, and Van Noy actually brings that up.
Okay.
But then we get to the historical context,
Okay.
and this is where things get really tricky.
Uh-oh.
Chapters 40 to 66, they talk about the Babylonian exile,
Right.
Cyrus, the Persian king who let the Israelites return,
Yeah.
as if it was already happening. But Isaiah lived well before the exile even started.
So how could he have known?
Yeah, could he have predicted these events in such detail?
Right. I mean, it's almost like
It's a tough one.
it challenges this whole idea of prophecy, right?
It does.
If prophets could really see into the future,
Yeah.
wouldn't it make sense for their words to reflect that future, even if it hadn't happened yet?
That's the heart of the debate right there.
Yeah.
Do you believe in divine revelation?
Right.
Could God have shown Isaiah what was going to happen,
Right.
allowing him to talk about it as if it was already unfolding?
Yeah.
That's where things get really interesting,
Yeah.
because Van Noy actually pushes back on these doubts.
Okay, I'm all ears. What does he say?
Well, Van Noy reminds us that Isaiah's ministry, it probably continued
Okay.
into the reign of King Manasseh.
Oh.
And that time period was full of apostasy,
Which is
turning away from
not
God,
wait, right.
and political turmoil.
Yeah.
The threat of exile, it was hanging over everyone's heads.
Like a dark cloud.
Exactly. And it's possible that Isaiah, he sensed this impending doom.
Yeah.
And he kind of shifted his ministry,
Right. Yeah.
became more private, comforting the faithful few who were left.
So it's like he saw the writing on the wall
Yeah.
and started preparing his people for
Okay.
what might be coming,
Yeah.
even if it seemed really far off at the time.
Yeah, like he was getting them ready
Yeah.
for the possibility.
Okay.
And think about it, for these people, they were facing persecution,
Yeah.
the possibility of exile,
Right.
that message of hope
Yeah.
and deliverance in chapters 40 to 66
Right.
would have been incredibly relevant.
Even if they weren't literally exiled yet.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Imagine like your world is falling apart and you hear these words, comfort, comfort my people, says your God.
Yeah.
powerful stuff, right?
Powerful, yeah.
And it's not just about the physical exile either.
Right.
It's about that emotional and spiritual context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like even if they weren't physically exiled, it's like they were experiencing a kind of spiritual exile.
Yeah.
That feeling of being isolated and just kind of lost.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And here's another interesting thing.
Okay.
Micah, who lived around the same time as Isaiah.
Okay.
He also predicted a Babylonian exile.
Oh, wow.
So the idea that this event was, you know, on the prophetic radar.
Yeah.
It wasn't so crazy after all.
Right.
It seems like a few different prophets were picking up on the vibe.
Yeah, like sensing something was coming.
Yeah, sensing that judgment and exile, those were real possibilities if people didn't turn back to God.
Yeah, like they were raising the alarm bells.
Exactly.
Wow, so there's definitely more to this whole authorship question than meets the eye.
Yeah, there always is.
All right, so we've talked about the doubts about Isaiah,
but
I know there's also evidence.
There is.
That supports him as the author of the whole book.
Right.
So let's get into that.
Okay, so Vannoy lays out some pretty strong arguments here.
Okay, I'm ready.
First, we've got the manuscript tradition.
Okay.
Think of it like this. There's no ancient manuscript out there that separates chapters 40 to 66.
Oh, interesting.
From the rest of Isaiah.
Okay.
It's always been presented as one book. Even the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are super old,
right,
2nd century BC, they present Isaiah as a complete work.
Okay.
So that's significant.
Yeah.
Because it suggests that the folks closest to the original text, they saw it as one whole piece.
So nobody just like stitched it together later or anything.
Right. It wasn't like some later edition.
Okay. That makes sense.
It was always meant to be together.
Okay. What about the New Testament, though?
Oh, yeah. Good point.
Does that say anything about this?
The New Testament consistently attributes both parts of the book to Isaiah.
Oh, okay.
For example, in John 12.3840,
okay,
it quotes from both sections of Isaiah.
Okay.
And specifically names Isaiah as the prophet.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it seems like the early Christians who knew their Hebrew scriptures really well, they also saw Isaiah as the author of the entire book.
So it wasn't even a question for them.
Not really.
Okay.
It was a given.
Okay, so we've got the manuscripts in the New Testament backing up Isaiah's authorship.
We do.
But I'm still kind of stuck on those stylistic differences that the critics bring up.
Yeah.
Does Vannoy just ignore those or what?
No, he doesn't ignore them.
Go ahead.
Instead of seeing those differences as evidence against Isaiah,
yeah,
he suggests that we think about the structure of chapters 40 to 66 in a different way.
All right, I'm listening.
He compares it to a symphony.
Wait, a symphony? Yeah, a musical composition.
How is a book of prophecy?
It's an interesting comparison.
Like a symphony.
Well, think about how a symphony works.
Okay.
You've got different movements,
right,
recurring themes, shifts in tempo and mood.
Yeah.
It's not always a straight line, you know? It's designed to make you feel something.
Yeah.
To create an overall impact.
Okay.
And Vannoy says Isaiah 40 to 66, it follows a similar pattern. Okay, so instead of just like a dry logical argument, it's more of an emotional and spiritual journey.
Exactly.
Right.
And that structure, it would have been really powerful for people in exile,
yeah,
who were longing for hope,
yeah,
and restoration. It's not just about laying out a logical argument.
Yeah.
It's about moving them, inspiring them, speaking to their hearts,
yeah,
as well as their minds.
Well, like a symphony of words.
You got it.
With these different movements and themes that build on each other to create this really powerful experience.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that structure, it helps us understand those shifts in style.
Right.
And focus that the critics point to.
Yeah.
They're not just random inconsistencies.
Okay.
They're part of a deliberate artistic design. Like the movements of a symphony.
Like a musical composition.
Exactly.
Okay. That's starting to make more sense now.
Good. Good.
So if Isaiah 40 to 66 is structured like a symphony, what are the major themes? Like, what are the movements, so to speak, that we hear throughout?
That's where it gets really exciting, honestly. Vannoy, he picks out five main themes that kind of work together like instruments in an orchestra to create this powerful and harmonious whole.
I like that. Okay, so break it down for me. What's the first movement of this symphony?
First movement, it's all about comfort.
Okay.
Isaiah 40, it starts with those amazing words, comfort. Comfort my people, says your God.
Oh, yeah.
Such a powerful message of deliverance, like deliverance from those immediate struggles they were facing, but also from that looming threat of exile.
Right.
Offering this incredible solace to people who were really hurting.
Yeah, it's like you can almost hear the tenderness in those words. Comfort, comfort my people.
Right.
It's not like a command.
No.
It's more like a plea.
It's an invitation.
Yeah, a whisper of hope in the middle of all this despair.
Yeah.
I mean, even today when I'm going through a rough patch, those words, they bring me so much peace.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's a timeless message. And that leads right into the second movement, which really emphasizes God's power. Isaiah just proclaims God's existence, his creative power, and his sovereignty over history. It's this big cosmic reality check.
Yeah. Like, no matter how bad things get, God is still in control. He hasn't abandoned his people.
Absolutely. He's still on the throne.
Yeah.
And it's this power that sets God apart from those powerless idols of Babylon.
Right, right.
And that brings us to our third movement, which focuses on the futility of idolatry. Isaiah contrasts the true God, the one who made the heavens and the earth, with the lifeless idols of Babylon.
It's like comparing a flickering candle to the sun.
Perfect analogy.
Yeah.
One is a pale imitation, the other is the source of all light and life. Isaiah is reminding his audience that these idols, they're nothing but human creations.
Right.
Powerless to save or deliver.
They can't do anything.
He's calling them back to the true God, the one who holds their future, their destiny in his hands.
It makes you think about all the things we put our faith in today, all those things that promise us security and happiness, but just end up letting us down.
That's so true.
It's like a good reminder to, I don't know, examine our own hearts and make sure we're not chasing after idols.
Absolutely. Whether they're those physical statues or just ideas and concepts.
Right.
And to drive this point home, Isaiah emphasizes God's omniscience, his ability to know and predict the future. That's our fourth movement.
Okay, so back to prophecy. God can see the big picture even when we can't.
Exactly. Isaiah uses the fulfillment of prophecy as proof of God's power.
Right.
He's basically saying, look, I told you this was going to happen, and it did. I know the end from the beginning, and I'm going to keep my promises.
Right, right.
It's meant to give them confidence in God, even when things look really bleak.
It's that reminder that God is in control.
Yeah, that he's working things out.
Think about a time when you just felt lost.
Yeah.
Uncertain about the future. Isaiah is telling us that even when we can't see the path, God knows where we're going. He's guiding us every step of the way.
That's a powerful message of hope, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
And that brings us to the fifth and final movement, the most intricate and maybe the most fascinating of them all. The servant of the Lord.
Oh, yeah. The servant of the Lord. We touched on this earlier, but it feels like a whole other deep dive waiting to happen.
It does. It really does.
Mm.
This theme runs through chapters 40 to 66, and it really reaches its peak in those powerful images of Isaiah 53.
Right.
It's the theme that has both captivated and puzzled scholars for ages, and is one we will definitely be diving into in a future episode.
Okay, well, consider my curiosity piqued. But before we get to those servant songs, I want to go back to those five themes. The comfort, God's power, the futility of idolatry, God's omniscience, and the servant of the Lord. They're so rich and complex. What's a takeaway for us today? You know, for those of us who aren't living in literal exile, but who are facing our own struggles and challenges.
You know, that's what's so amazing about these themes. They're rooted in a specific time and place, but they go beyond that and speak to this universal human experience.
So even though we're, what, like 2,500 years removed from the Babylonian exile, these themes still resonate.
Absolutely. The message of comfort, it reminds us that God is with us in our pain, whatever form it takes. We all experience loss. We experience disappointment.
Yeah.
Isaiah reminds us that we're not alone in those dark moments. God sees our pain, and he offers us comfort and hope.
And the emphasis on God's power, that assures us that he can work in our lives even when things feel impossible.
It's like when God closes a door, he opens a window.
Yeah, yeah.
We may not always see the whole plan, but we can trust he's working behind the scenes.
Right.
Bringing good out of what seems bad.
Yeah.
And the theme of idolatry, well, that pushes us to check our own hearts.
Yeah.
To make sure we're not putting our trust in things that are ultimately empty. So easy to get caught up in the pursuit of success or wealth or status or just being liked.
Right.
That we forget what truly matters.
Right. The things that are really important.
Isaiah is reminding us that true satisfaction, true security comes from God alone.
Yeah. He's asking us, what are you really worshiping? What's the foundation of your life?
And the theme of God's omniscience, that gives us hope that he has a plan.
Even when we can't see it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We don't have to have it all figured out.
Yeah. This is so encouraging because it's like, we don't have to have all the answers.
Right.
We don't have to figure everything out on our own.
You can just trust.
Yeah.
Trust that he knows what he's doing.
Right.
That he's guiding us towards something bigger than ourselves.
Yeah.
And as for the servant of the Lord, well, we'll save that for another conversation.
Sure.
But the very idea of someone who suffers for others, that speaks to something deep inside of us. Something about the nature of love, the nature of sacrifice.
Yeah.
It makes us ask, what does it mean to live a life of service?
Right.
How can we reflect God's love and compassion in a world that needs it so badly?
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there.
There is.
Even though we're so far removed from that Babylonian exile, these themes are still so incredibly relevant. They speak to those deep longings we all have for comfort, for hope, for something bigger than ourselves.
You've summed it up beautifully. It's like we're all part of this bigger story.
Yeah.
This grand symphony orchestrated by a God who loves us and who wants to bring us back to wholeness.
You know, it's really incredible to think that a text that was written thousands of years ago can still be so relevant today. It's like those themes, you know, comfort and hope and God's power, it's like they're woven into what it means to be human.
Yeah, it really is amazing. And what's really hit me during this whole deep dive is that these themes, as comforting as they are, they're also kind of challenging. You know, they make us look at our own lives and how we're living and what we prioritize and our relationship with God.
Yeah, you're right. It's not just about, you know, receiving comfort. It's about lining ourselves up with God and recognizing his power and trusting in that.
Exactly. Letting go of those idols, trusting in his plan for us, and embracing a life of service.
Okay, so let's bring it back to this whole authorship debate. Where do we land on that? We've gone back and forth. What are your thoughts?
Well, like we've seen, there's no easy answer, right? The evidence pointing to Isaiah as the author, it's pretty strong, especially with the manuscripts and the New Testament always saying it was him.
But what about those stylistic differences and the historical stuff? That's pretty hard to just ignore.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's where Van Oy's idea about the symphony structure is so helpful. It helps us see those differences, not as contradictions, but like you said, as part of the artistic design.
Like those shifts, those changes, they actually make the whole thing more emotionally powerful, like the different parts of a symphony.
Exactly. And in the end, whether you believe Isaiah wrote the whole thing or whether someone else added to it later, the message is still powerful.
Right. The message is what matters.
And it still speaks to us today.
Yeah. That's what I find so reassuring. It doesn't really matter who wrote it. It still offers us wisdom and guidance for life and faith.
Yeah. You said it.
Yeah.
They remind us that God is with us in our struggles, that he's in control, and that he has a plan, even when we can't see it.
Well, my brain is officially full. We've covered so much, the authorship debate, the structure of Isaiah, those five themes that we talked about.
It's been a journey.
But we can't end without talking about that elephant in the room, the servant of the Lord.
Oh, yeah. We've kind of danced around it, haven't we?
Yeah, it definitely feels like a whole other deep dive.
It is, for sure. But before we go there, I want to leave you with this question. What do you think about the servant of the Lord? What does that mean to you?
That's a great question for everyone to think about. It's like a cliffhanger ending to our deep dive. It makes you want to keep learning more.
Think of it as an invitation to continue the journey.
Well, that's it for today's deep dive into Isaiah. Thank you so much for being here. And remember, this is just the beginning. Keep exploring, keep learning, and we'll see you next time for another deep dive. Until then, keep those brains buzzing.